My name is Dolores Ledbetter, and I teach elementary school. Have been an elementary teacher for 17 years. I had a 10-year layoff when our children were young, and I also teach a couple of classes at California Lutheran College, one of them being children's literature. And today I talked about children's literature earlier in the week. I think some of you were there, but today it's not going to be children's literature. Today is going to be storytelling. And one of my personal crusades is to find people who have time on their hands, who are retired or whatever, not necessarily retired, but anyone who has time on their hands that would like to come into our Lutheran schools, our Christian day schools. I have spent my whole professional career in the Lutheran day school. And last year I had two people from the church who came in since I was doing this recruiting, this little crusade of mine, that came in as aides and part of the time and storytellers. A couple of older people in our congregation who did have time on their hands. And they were really afraid at first. So today, part of my presentation is to encourage any of you who may have time on your hands to volunteer your services as a storyteller or as an aide to help teachers. I know they would be very willing for your help. And don't be afraid. Children are a much better audience usually than adults. And they will accept you. And also, especially if you're coming in to just tell stories and you're somebody new. Teacher gets to be pretty old hat. And so when I had this one person in to tell stories to my fifth grade, he did a beautiful, beautiful job. And so how do you tell a story? That's what I want to do today. I want to encourage you, and then I want to tell you that they are a very willing audience. And all you have to be is yourself. And you don't have to be terribly dramatic. If that's the way you are, fine. But if it isn't, then just tell the story. That kind of reminds me of Walt Bowman. Maybe some of you have heard of Walt Bowman. He's a professor of theology at Columbia. He comes up to Holden here. He's a lot of tapes. And he's really quite a speaker. And one session he had was on telling Bible stories, and he said, just tell the story. And I heard him that year, and that's been a long time ago, one of my first years up here at Holden. And I went back to my school and I did that. I just told the story. I didn't try to make any great moral implications or any because they're there, and I just told the story. And the Bible stories. And the kids really, he's right. Just tell the story. And that is true of just children's stories. Before I go into some good stories to tell, I want anyone who is interested, Charlotte Huck is a real expert in children's literature, and she has two lists. And I don't have them with me, but some people came up to me and were interested in these lists. And if you take the time to stay after and put your name and address, I will mail you any of these lists, anyone who wants it. And one is called 100 Best Books to Read Aloud to Children. And if you really are sincere and want it, I'd be more than happy to mail it to you. And I won't be able to mail it to you till we get back home, which will be January or February. But if you'll be patient and wait for it, that list is called 100 Best Books to Read Aloud to Children. The other list is called Books for Ages and Stages. And it has it's a beautiful thing. It has the age of the child, for instance, 3 and 4 year olds. What is characteristic of that child? And then a whole list of books that fit for that age. And then age 4 and 5. And goes all the way up to about age 12, 13, this particular list. So if you're really interested and stay after and put your name and address on one of these, I'd be more than happy to mail it to you. Okay, let's get into some books, and I promised at that last session that I would tell this story. This is one of my favorites. But before I do that, would you like to hear stories?
Sure.
How can you be a good storyteller? That's what I was going to tell you. You can be dramatic if that's what you are, as I said, or you can just mainly be yourself and tell what you think is important, what is important to you. Because what is important to you will be important to the children. Because Monday I was saying, what makes good children's literature? Just what makes good adult literature. Good characters, good plot, good setting. I'm going to start with picture books. And I'll just go through these pretty quickly. Now, picture books are mainly for ages, 2 and 3 year olds on up to about 2nd grade, 7 year olds. But even up to 5th graders enjoy this picture book, which is Peter Spear. And this is over in the bookstore. This is on people. Peter Spear also did the one, find it here, Noah's Ark, which is in the bookstore over there. And he is a beautiful, beautiful illustrator. Very detailed drawings. And you really need a small group of children sitting around you to see these pictures, to show them, because they're really delightful. And some of you, I'm repeating myself, but he talks about people here. And there's Adam and Eve and the great detail of the world. And then he tells about how people are all very different. And then he has all the different kinds of eyes and shapes of bodies. And then I love the noses. The noses and the ears. And then what is beautiful in one place is not beautiful in another. And then he goes into games and how we entertain ourselves and our culture compared to other cultures, and houses. Just a really interesting book. And then he goes into language, even into language. And I read this earlier when we were here. I had a storytelling session for some of the children. Narnia had closed, and there were still quite a few children. And so I had storytelling for the children. And when I opened this page, several of them were looking for the English, and they were straining, and it's not there. But they were really interested in this book. And then, of course, at the very end, this is the clincher. The if there is a lesson, this is it. It shows how differences are what make our world so great. And I always have a big sign on in my room that says, thank God for differences, because the world would be pretty dull. And so here's the city. If all the cars were the same, all the buildings, all the people are dressed alike, and then you turn the page and it's the same street, and I want you to see the difference. It's the very same street, and of course, everything is different. The buildings are all different. The people are all different. The cars. And it's really quite a contrast. Then he does a beautiful job. Have you, any of you seen this book, Noah's Ark? Oh, look in the bookstore. It's also up in Jenny's corner. These books, I'm putting them all back today. And you can go up there and browse about. There's a beautiful selection of books up there. And it shows what Noah really had to go through in getting all those animals into the ark. It shows all of the different cages he had to have. And then it shows him trying to get all these cages on and separating the animals, the ones that didn't get along, the ones who did. And then the big problem of disposing of all that excrement. I mean, have you thought about that? And there he is shoveling away, trying to dispose of all this, and trying to feed all those animals, finding little nooks and crannies for these different animals, and just and the expressions on their faces as he's shoveling away and trying to, and here he is, he's trying to, well, and all the insects, And of course, he has them in different jars, and he's going to feed those. And then he has to have a place for the hippos. He has to have water. He has a water place, some water in that ark. And, it just goes on, and there he is. He's exhausted. At the end of the day, he's sitting there all by his lonesome. And then, of course, the story proceeds, and he sends the bird out. And then at the very end, all the animals are leaving, and then I love this picture. What the ark, can you imagine what the ark looked like when they all got out of there? What a mess. And that's what the kids say. They say, what a mess. And it isn't. That's Peter Speer, S-P-I-E-R. And if you'll notice, here is a gold medal, and that's a gold Caldecott winning book, and that's the best illustrated. They pick out the best illustrated book every year, and it's named after Randolph Caldecott, who was the earliest real children's illustrator. And I won't go into that today, but
is the story in the beginning of the book, or is it just all pictures?
No, there's some text.
Yeah, there is text.
Mm-hmm. In this, and it goes, it starts out high and long, thick and strong, wide and stark was the ark. It's rhymed all the way through. But with Peter Speer, it's more the illustrations. And then I want to get, while I'm on that, I want to get to a person who does just illustrations, just pictures, to tell you that a book can have just pictures and tell a story. I don't think I have the Silver Pony here, but the Silver Pony is a book for, I do have it. The Silver Pony is a book that is just pictures, and this is for an older child. And what is really good about this book, they used to have it in the bookstore, and I can't remember if they do now. We bought this for our daughter, and she was about 14 at the time. And she really enjoyed this book because it's all pictures. And then beside the picture is a blank page, and they can write their own story. And they look at all the pictures first, and then they write in their story. And this is really for a child who can write, who, and I suppose some really bright third grade on up really could handle this. But the story is such a sensitive one that it can be taken into teens. And that's kind of good, because a lot of the things you may wonder what to give to your young teenager. And this, 10-year-olds, too, anywhere from 10 to 12 to 13, 14, depending on the child, of course. This is a beautiful, beautiful book. Would you like me just to flip a little bit into it? This boy, there he's standing. It takes quite a while. I mean, I've got a lot to get through here, but he lives, and you know, I'm kind of telling my story here. If I could write it, I look at it, there's a farm, and it's kind of way out, and he's going to do his chores, and it looks like he's got kind of a lonely look on his face. And there he really does. He's feeding the chickens, and he looks like he's thinking about something. His mind is way off. It doesn't look like it's on his work. There he goes to feed the hogs, and he still doesn't look like his... And there he is with the cows, and he lets the cows out into the pasture. And there he is laying, and he looks very, very lonely. He looks like he's really daydreaming, thinking about something. And then way off in the distance, we see something. And, of course, we know that it's his imagination. And there is a silver pony. And he sees it. He really sees it. And it's so real to him. And if you've had daydreams that, or dreams that are so real, and it's so real to him that it actually frightens him for a minute, and he runs to tell his father. And, of course, his father, he stops the tractor, and his father's very busy. And he runs back. And there's no silver pony. And his father says, don't bother me at my work. And of course, he insists that he's right, that he really has seen it. What does he get? he gets a spanking. And then, so who does he go to? He goes to mom, to mother, to see if she's going to listen. Well, she's busy too. And she gives him another chore to pick apples. And who comes but the pony again? And the pony takes him on many adventures to deliver these apples. He delivers apples to a child who lives up in Alaska who has no apples. He delivers to these loggers who have no apples. And it goes on that way, and there he is delivering it to this lonely boy who also is kind of in his position out taking care of the sheep. And up and up and away he goes. And finally, at the end, the pony takes him higher and higher and higher and higher, clear up to the sun and the moon and the stars and rockets, and suddenly blast and crash, and down he comes, down, down, there he's falling, and of course down to home, back down to reality. And out come his parents, who, and I want you to notice this expression, the father loves him very much, and you can see that. And even though had been kind of harsh with him, you get the feeling that he works very, very hard, and he was sweaty and hot the day he got stopped on his tractor. But he loves the boy very much. There's the mother calling. The doctor comes out, looks at the boy, and the parents are really very concerned, you can see there. And there's the boy, and he's looking off. Still, he's got that lonely. And all of a sudden, here comes Dad with something. And what does he bring him? A real pony. Isn't that kind of a neat, neat story? And there he is. There he is at the... But that's kind of appeals to a broad broad age, more than... Now, these are more for younger children with just pictures. But this is one that... This is Lynn Ward, L-Y-N-D.
She writes a lot of...
Right, right. Uh-huh. Really good. And that one was in our bookstore, but I don't know if it still is. I know the other Peter Spear are. But here's another one. And this is, I don't think I say this right, but I say it the way I want, the way it looks to me. Mitsumasa Anyo. And... these are just pictures, and this is Anyo's animals, and what he does, and the children love this, is he puts animals into his fine detailed pictures, and you probably can't see them from there, but there are animals, and the children love to pick those out. This is all pictures, and this is for usually younger children, but the animals are right there. You can really see the swan. And that's one here too by the same illustrator. And this is a journey, and you follow it somewhat like the Silver Pony, and it's all pictures, but it tells the story itself, just the pictures. Very detailed, beautiful illustrations. And the younger children really enjoy this, and all you really have to do, now my mouth is going blah 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 blah, but all you would really have to do is just turn the pages and let them think about them. Silence is a wonderful thing. I was up weaving, and yesterday I was trying to finish a weaving, and you get 2 days to do it, and I was busy the day before, so yesterday I was up there from right after breakfast. I finished 2 minutes before Vespers, but some of the people up there weaving had to put a tape of music on, and I was fine because it was neat music, but when I was up there by myself, I just loved to sit there and just listen to the thump of the pump. It had a nice, pleasant thump about it, the loom. I couldn't think of the word, thank you, the loom, blunk, and just the silence was just nice, and so... give the children maybe some silence. And remember, if you're going to do some storytelling, that young children have very short attention spans. And that's just part of growing up. So if you're going to be telling a story, you might want to put some kind of a little project in with it. And it can be something very simple. If you're dealing with winter, it might be making snowflakes. The teachers, you can usually check with the teacher and get all the supplies you want. But just remember that young children can't sit for an hour. I had storytelling here with these four-year-olds for an hour. Well, obviously, I couldn't sit for an hour and tell stories. I'd tell a story, and then we'd have to do something and get up. And I had some little simple projects in between. Older children, like fifth grade, can sit for a longer period of time and listen. They have longer attention spans. But that's just picture book. And then you might, one way to do some storytelling is to do it with a theme in mind. And here's another award-winning book. This is Ezra Jack Keats, who's really a good illustrator too. And this is A Snowy Day, a beautiful story. And so you might want to just have a theme of winter, or you might have a theme of friends. When I was storytelling here, I had blueberries for Sal. I don't think I have it with me. Maybe I do. This is McCloskey, who is really good. He writes and illustrates. Beautiful artist. And I told this real old classic, this is one of his older ones, Blueberries for Sal, because at the time the blueberries were ripe up here, and I went up and picked some on the Holden Trail and brought them back. And so we sat and ate the blueberries and we read the story. And this is a beautiful story about a little girl who goes berry picking with her mother, and they meet a mother bear and a baby bear who are berry picking. And it tells how the child is afraid of the bear, but the bear is also afraid, the baby bear is afraid of the mother. So there's a lot of things that you can do with this one. And then that took up, would you believe, we took up a whole hour with that, because by the time I told the story, we ate the blueberries, and then they drew pictures of Holden. Some of them had been out on little hikes, and they drew pictures of what it was like around here and what it would be like if they had seen a bear. And then we discussed, they got in a big discussion about bears are wild animals and you don't get close to them. They brought this up, which was, and so we got into a big discussion about they're just enjoy from a distance. And so there again, if you're storytelling, you may have some things planned, but don't just look at your list and think, boy, I got to get to this, and just cut them off and say, well, this is next. If they get off on something, I had other things planned that day, but if they get off on something and are really interested, just chuck your other plans. You can use those for another day and pursue what they are interested in. And it took up, just this one book took up the whole hour. I thought, oh, that's good. The next day I was clamoring for things to do. But that's Robert McCloskey. He also wrote Lentil, Maine Summer, which is a beautifully done book. And he goes from fine line drawings in here, and Maine Summer is watercolor. Completely different, doesn't even look like the same artist, but beautifully done. Okay, and then this one, this is a delightful character called a Tomten, and this is taken from, I do not come from the Scandinavian background. I happen to be very Irish, a stranger in a strange land among all these Scandinavians, but this is a Scandinavian story taken from a very old, back in Scandinavian myth or legend or whatever. And this little character called Tom Ten visits and talks with all the animals, and he's quite delightful. And I've got to tell you what happened to me. I was up there, and earlier we had power failures constantly because the village was full and the water level was down. And it's pitch black in here, by the way. And I was up there with 10 children that day. And there were 10 of them in there. And I was telling them, I was just opened this. I just had this book and I had just ready. And they had not seen the cover. And I was starting to tell this story and the lights went out absolutely pitch black. Well, there was a little bit of light coming in the window. So I stepped out up to the doorway and my brain was going, do I move them all out here? Well, they were busy pounding in there, and if I moved out, it would be impossible because they were going back and forth, and I thought, what am I going to do? So that's what you're going to have to do, think fast on your feet, too, a little bit. I thought, I know, I'll just step out and read this story and not let them see the pictures at all, and then I'll have them draw what they think a Tompton looks like. So that's what we did. And I had them great big pieces of paper. So they had great big illustrations. And they all did something very different. And then when they were all done, we actually looked at him. But he visits all the animals, and he even visits the human children. And it says, he tiptoes across to the children's cot and stands looking for a long time. If they would only wake up, then I could talk to them in Tompton language, a silent little language that children can understand. But children sleep at night, so he can't talk to them. And then at the very end, it says, winters come and summers go, year follows year, but as long as people live at the old farm in the forest, every night the Tompton will trip around between the houses on his small, silent feet. And this writer has done several of these. And it says, it's adapted from a poem written by Rindberg, a Swedish writer. And this writer has won the Hans Christian Andersen Medal, which is another medal that is given. Then I'll move on.
They must be related to leprechauns.
Yes, I would think so. I know about leprechauns.
And hobbits,
yeah. The neat little people. Do you know, did any of you see the Reader's Theater when it was here? It was a week ago. Did you? You saw it. Well, there was a Reader's Theater, and then in it, there was the song, Tura Lura Lura. And do you know that? I was just really put out because 2/3 of the people didn't even know what that song was. Do you know what? The Irish Lullaby. And several people came up to the to David, who was singing it, and they said, will you sit? He was singing it
exaggerated.
And they came up and wanted him to sing it seriously because they said, that's a pretty melody. And they hadn't heard the Irish Lullaby. And I thought, boy. I mean, in the school where I teach, the 11th of May, what is it, the 5th of May or 11th of May, the Scandinavian? 17th, okay. Mm-hmm. Right, we celebrate that with all the Scandinavian, we have so many Scandinavian children in our school that they bring in their grandma and their great-grandmas, beautiful made things, and they tell about them, and they bring in some stories, and oh, it's really beautiful. So you see, I know all about that. I don't always remember the date, but they didn't know that Irish lullaby.
You had heard Bing Crosby then.
Yeah. Right. And then this is, I promised you would hear this story, some of you, so I'm going to get to it. This is a beautiful thing. This is Shel Silverstein. And that's the Giving Tree.
It was in the bookstore.
Mm-hmm, that's in the book.
I saw it there one day, and I went back the next day to get it, and I couldn't find it.
You might.
No, I'm going to take it home to Jeffrey.
It's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful book.
Yeah, I didn't like that. I'm looking for me. I'm going to get my suitcases closed.
This is it has a beautiful story, and earlier in the week I was telling about why children's literature, what makes children's literature, and you know, it's plot, character, setting. Another thing is universal themes. The real thing that makes any good literature. What are universal themes? Well, it's dealing with love and hate, good and evil, birth and death, and aging, and just part of life. And this book is a beautiful illustration of that. Another one is this. It's a real classic, Charlotte's Web. And it deals with birth and death, because Charlotte really dies in this story. The spider dies. And so death is a very real thing. And but there's promise of all her little babies being born. And so that's birth and death.
Children sit and cry when they read that book.
Right. It's a beautiful book. And And I got to tell you about this, because the year this book came out, it did not win the Newbery Book Award. The Newbery Book Award is the award for the best content, named after John Newbery, who was, I guess you could consider him, we can really thank him for being the first person to publish something really for children specifically. And I talked more about that on John Newbery on Monday, so I won't go into it now, but the year Charlotte's Web was up, it didn't win, and a book called Secret of the Andes did. And I know that none of you have heard of Secret of the Andes, but it's a beautiful book, too. And it's about a young boy who lives all by himself. Well, he doesn't live by himself, but he's the only child with this older shepherd up in the Andes. And it goes into his religion, which is the religion of the sun god. And it goes into his culture. And his, what he, you know, what is important to their culture, and what is important for him to know as a boy, that's different from what's important for someone in our culture to know. So it's a beautifully done book, but it doesn't measure up to Charlotte's Web, because it doesn't. It has characters, setting, all of that, but it doesn't have the universal themes that this, and that's what makes the difference. And that brings me into this book, C.S. Lewis, and you're all familiar with C.S. Lewis. You're dealing with the same thing in the Narnia series. You're dealing with Tolkien, too. Tolkien, the same thing. There's a great distinction between good and evil, love and hate, death, here, and you know, the lion is a Christ. You could pick that, and usually the children pick that up. It's a Christ-like symbol. And you know, he dies. And so there is death in here. And then the children grieve. There is real grief. And there's one touching scene in this first book where the children are really grieving. They have that terrible, empty feeling. And so this really deals realistically, C.S. Lewis does. Beautiful books. These are, you can buy in a set. The first one is called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then they go on. I know you're familiar with these. John Schramm this morning in his Bible study, and most of you were probably there, talked about the farmer he went to. And did you all hear that story? He went to the farmer and he says, what am I going to do about these, was it groundhogs, wasn't it? Eating all my crops. And this farmer says, well, we just plant enough for both of us, for the groundhogs and for us. And that made me think, and I was raced up to Jenny's Corner to get the book, and I couldn't find it. I know it's up there. There's a beautiful children's book on that subject, and it's by a famous writer named Robert Lawson, and it's called Rabbit Hill. Many of you heard of Rabbit Hill? Okay. And Rabbit Hill is about, it's a fantasy, and you know, fantasy is when animals talk, people can do great things and so forth. And in Rabbit Hill, this new family comes to this farm, and the animals are, they said, new family, new family, what are they going to be like? And the old family had tried to trap the animals, had tried to put poison down and whatever, and so they were all looking to this new family. Well, the gist of it is the story goes on and on, but at the end, the new family puts what is it? Isn't it Christopher, the Saint Christopher, the animals? Isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's Christopher, isn't it?
Francis.
Thank you. Christopher is safety, isn't it? Safety. I knew I wasn't right. It's Francis. Thank you. They at the end, the new people build a fountain with a statue, and the animals don't know at first what the statue is. And they, of course, it's St. Francis. And the new people plant a huge garden, and they bring all the excess and put it around this fountain for the animals at the end. So it kind of reminded me of his. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. Another famous children's writer that you might want to be, Rabbit Hill is a story, by the way. I should give some ages here. These picture books, I set up to second grade, although older, don't be fooled, older children enjoy them. Even up to seventh and eighth graders, although a seventh and eighth grader wouldn't want you to believe that. But they do. It's just not cool to enjoy these. That reminds me of a program we have at our school. We have a fine arts program on Wednesday, usually Wednesdays, sometimes it was Thursdays. But from right after chapel until noon, they have electives. And we ran this program. The reason it went clear down to fifth grade was because they needed me. It ran from fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. And I handled art and drama. And so they needed my services. So they had to make it run clear to fifth grade. Well, we wondered how that would work out. Combining fifth graders with seventh, a combination class of fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth graders. We wondered, how's that going to really work? Well, it turned out working terrific, just like the old one-room school. The seventh and eighth graders quit putting on this macho image because they caught on to the enthusiasm of the little fifth graders. The fifth graders could learn from the expertise of the seventh and eighth graders. And we put on fabulous plays, and we didn't have all this horsing around from these seventh and eighth graders that you get when you get all of them together, I think that's the trouble with the junior high school. You put all that age in one place, and all they can do is think of how one can outdo the other one, But I'm digressing there, but that just proves that that seventh and eighth graders, part of it is just show. Well, all of it, really. They really enjoy these things. And so our program combining those classes has really worked out. They get a choice of art and drama. I'll continue my story. Journalism, instrumental music, and choral music. Those are their electives. And we do that one morning a week. Anyway, this is enjoyed by very young children, even read aloud. But for reading level, you're talking about like fourth grade. A very good third grader. I know some really good third graders who can read this. But fifth graders love it. This is, and sixth, seventh, eighth, right on up. Tolkien, by the way, The Lord of the Rings, is pretty difficult reading. And you're talking about junior high mainly there. Although I have had fifth graders, some very good fifth graders read it. But it's Tolkien is for fifth grade to adult. And so are all these books, really. Like anybody would enjoy Charlotte's Web and The Giving Tree. Cricket in Times Square. George Selden is another good writer I want you to know. And this is enjoyed. Cricket in Times Square could be enjoyed by any level read aloud. But if they want to read it themselves, there again you're talking about fourth grade on up. Good fourth grader can read this. Some really good third graders can read this. Cricket in Times Square is, again, the universal theme of friendship, helping. That's what this is, really. What it means to be a friend. And Charlotte's Web touches on that. So many of these. What does it really mean to be a friend? It means really putting yourself out. Covers that great theme of friendship. Someone asked me, this is a beautiful story, too. This is Ezra Jack Keats, Peter's Chair. I told this story Monday. And Hi, Cat. Ezra Jack Keats does just beautiful, beautiful work. And Peter's Chair is one of my favorites, just one of my very favorites. And for some of you who weren't here, Peter gets a new little sister, and he sees that his crib is being painted pink. And he says to himself, "That's my crib." And then the crib, and then his high chair is being painted pink. And he said, "That was my high chair." And pretty soon, all that's left is his little blue sitting chair there. And he takes it and leaves, and he's going to run away. And his mom looks out, and she pleads with him and says, we're having something awfully good for lunch. And that kind of brings him back in. He comes back in, and he discovers he hasn't sat in that chair for a while. And he sits in the chair, and he discovers, lo and behold, he's too big for the chair. So he suggests to his father, he goes out, and he says, "Why don't we paint this chair pink?" And his father says, "Why don't we sit you?" And this is a beautiful. And there they are painting the chair pink. And where's that one picture I like? He says, "Why don't we put you in the big chair at the dinner table?" So he gets to sit in the big chair. It's here somewhere. Well, I can't find it now, but at the end, he gets to sit in a big grown-up chair, and so he's willing to give up his chair. And that's a universal theme of growing up, getting older, the responsibilities, what you gain, what you lose. That's a real universal theme that appeals to all ages.
Jealousy, too.
Jealousy, right. Right.
You absolutely need that kind of things to orient the older child to accept the younger child.
Right. And he does he's just one of my favorite writers. And I'll skip on here to, this is an award-winning book, too, called Caught Frog and Toad Are Friends, and this is one of the I Can Read books. And some of the I Can Read things that came out were not too good, but these particular ones are really excellent, are really well done. And there's a whole series, Frog and Toad, and they're just beautifully done. And they are the simple I Can Read books that the very, very young reader can read. And they're really well done. And I bring these because there are a lot of I Can Read kind of things that are out that are not as well done as this.
The author?
And these are Arnold LaBelle. And it's put out by Harper and Row, the I Can Read series. Beautifully done. And then I found this book, and I know the Marxhausen family, and I wasn't familiar. This is put out by Augsburg, and it's called Thank God for Circles. And I just want to share this book. I wasn't familiar with this until this summer. I hadn't seen this book. Has anyone seen this? Mm-hmm. Isn't that a beautiful book?
I have some of it. I guess maybe I didn't look at it clearly enough, but my son had a copy of it, and I never quite figure out what's going on. Maybe I'm just tense.
Oh.
I did do some explaining as I went with the children. You would have to do some explaining. I had, when I did this book, I don't know, you heard Mary Schramm's Vespers the other night. She talked about there were six young retarded girls here. And we had I had those six retarded girls for story time. And along with other little children. And that was an experience because one little child was afraid. Because here are these girls, they were bigger than I am. And they were laughing and they were delightful. They were a delightful audience. They loved all these stories. They, they had the mentality of a 3 or 4 year old. But this frightened this one little 4 year old girl because she hadn't been around that. And I talked to the mother about it. But it was a good experience for the other children because they kind of looked at them and I just went on as if they were all going to enjoy the story and it didn't matter. And I didn't explain anything because that wasn't the time to do it. And we just went along with story time, and pretty soon everybody just accepted everybody. But those girls really enjoyed, but I had them draw, we physically did it, I drew lines to them, and but I'll go through it really, really quick, and I did some explaining. It says, a line starts here, and it, you know, it can go out to you, just a straight line. And it stops, a line starts and stops. But a circle just is. It doesn't begin and it doesn't end. A circle is like God, no beginning and no end. Like a circle, God just is. He is forever. Round things remind us of circles and forever and God and things. So when we look around and we see all kinds of round things like oranges, they remind us of God. They have no beginning or ending. We see the round balloons, they remind us. And the peas and the snowman, lots of things are round in the world that can be reminders to us. The sun looks like a circle. We think of God who made it to warm us and to help. And flowers grow and they have circles in their center lots of times. The moon looks like a circle. We think of God who protects us through the night and forever. A ball is like a circle. We think of God who brings us joy into our lives and wants us to be happy forever. The world is like a line. It had a beginning. The world had a beginning. And the world will have an end. You and I, we started as a line begins. But when we come to the end of our line, we begin as a line and we come to the end of the line, we will find a circle. We will not be, it will not have an end, but we will find our circle.
Yeah, the trouble with me about that is that it seems like the conceptualization is far, far too advanced for a lot of kids to comprehend. That's the trouble with me. And my son, who is fairly quick in the word, could not comprehend that. I mean, it was beyond it. Whereas something like a giving tree, you know, or the people one.
Right.
Those are things where they can. And it seems to me this is a situation where an author wanted to tell a concept and sought that way of getting it out. And adults can probably grasp it. I think for kids it's really young. Maybe that's too judgmental.
No, you're right. I had to explain. I had to draw pictures. And we drew lines and how a line had a beginning or an end. And then I did have to go in that our lives will not have an end, but they will be like the circle. No, you're right. I had to do some explaining.
Yeah.
Where you don't have to explain people. You don't have to explain the giving tree.
In fact, they can explain it to you. If you want.
Right. As I said.
A little kindergarten age child, and that was a matter of drawing. They were a big class of five-year-olds. And they were to take a paper and fold it and open it and fold it the other way, you know, which sounds so simple. And he folded it the first way and opened it, and then he started and he said, I can't because that line gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Real imagination or something going on there.
I learn something every year. I've been teaching fifth grade now for 11 years. And for my sanity, if you teach fifth grade, and you don't want to be, you know, I had professors that used to, I felt like they came in and plugged in the plug and they had been teaching the same class for, I don't know, 20 years and they just plugged it in and you went and sat back and the mouth went. For my own sanity, I do something different every year. I teach the same things. Fifth grade is fifth grade. And I have children, our school doesn't have much turnover. The children usually go all the way through our school. We don't have that much mobility, fortunately, in our community. We have some, but one boy this past year, I always have a few, but one boy particularly came up, and he said, we didn't do that last year. I said, I know you didn't. I said, but you did so-and-so, which I'm not doing this year. I said, if I don't do something different, Andy, I said, I'll go crazy teaching fifth grade for so long. I said, if it's not interesting to me, it's sure not going to be interesting to you.
Didn't have the same kids last year either.
Right. You have different children, and then you really, teachers, remember that when you're telling stories, because you'll be teachers too. You have to do something for yourself. I really believe that. I mean, I have to do it for myself too. If I'm not happy with it or feel good about it, then it's not going to go over to the children either. I mean, I have to feel good. Okay, let me get... somebody asked me about what's good stories. I am also a reading specialist. I deal with kids every summer. I have a special program at our school that's open to the community that deals with kids with real reading problems. Anyone can send them. It's a tutorial, 5 or 6 students to a teacher with an aide. And I get kids who are so turned off to the printed word that I would hand them anything to read. I'd hand them a comic book, labels on cans, anything that just so they'd read. I mean, so I do not tend to ban, for instance, many librarians don't like children to read Nancy Drew and Hardy Boy books because they are so much things that are much better. Well, that's true. They're very, very right. And in our library, Jack and I both were on a crusade to get the Hardy Boys and the Nancy Drew back because they had removed them from our local library. And they have put them back.
Kids do read them.
Right, they do. And I read every Nancy Drew book that was available. But then I read a lot of other books, too. And I have readers in the 5th grade who read all the Nancy Drew, all the Hardy Boys, but they read the other books, too. They read all of the C.S. Lewis. And another series like that is the Great Brain series. That isn't great literature, but the kids love it. And this is John Fitzgerald. And it's just pleasurable, adventuresome type reading. And so I don't object to these. I think that if you can encourage other things that are better, that's great too. But I really don't believe in pushing aside these other books that they might, if they are reading. Because when you see kids that are so turned off to reading. Anyway, I wanted to get to this before I stop. And this is one of my favorites, and this is Lloyd Alexander. Anyone familiar with Lloyd Alexander? Most people aren't. And this, Lloyd Alexander took some of the same sources as Tolkien, some of the Welsh legends and Arthurian myths and so forth, but mainly Lloyd Alexander takes from the ancient Welsh. And in the beginning it says, this chronicle of the land of Prydain, and the land in here, he creates his own land just like Tolkien has Middle Earth and C.S. Lewis has Narnia. This is Prydain. Prydain is not Wales, not entirely at least. The inspiration for it comes from the magnificent land and its legends, but essentially Prydain is a country existing only in the imagination. A few of its inhabitants are drawn from the ancient tales. Gwydion, for example, is a real legendary figure. Arwen, the dread lord of Anyavan, comes from the Mabinogion, and I don't know how to pronounce it, the classic collection of Welsh legends. Though in Prydain he is considerably more villainous, and there is an authentic mythological basis for Arwen's cauldron. Henwen, the oracular pig, the old enchanter Dalban, and others. However, Taran, the assistant pig keeper, like Ialanwi. I want to say it so it sounds Welsh. I'm sure that's the way. It's Ialanwi, of the red gold hair, was born in my own Prydain. The geography of Prydain is peculiar to itself. Any resemblance between it and Wales is perhaps not coincidental. The Chronicle of Prydain is a fantasy. Such things never happen in real life, or do they? Most of us are called on to perform tasks far beyond what we believe we can do. Our capabilities seldom match our aspirations, and we are often woefully unprepared. To this extent, we are all assistant pig keepers at heart. And Lloyd Alexander writes that preface. And what does he mean by that? Well, this is a whole series. And Lloyd Alexander does something which is quite extraordinary. This first book, called The Book of Three, is about fourth, fifth grade reading level. The next one, called The Black Cauldron, is about a little higher reading level. Then the next one is a little higher. And the finally, the last one, The High King, is like seventh and eighth grade level. It's almost like the child can grow up. Now, I have had fifth graders, really good readers, get so turned on to this particular series that they read all of them, even though the reading level is much higher. They get through them. Why do I like this? Because it allows the younger child to experience some of what Tolkien had, only this is on a much more elementary level. And as you read this, you'll see that they did use some of the same sources because the characters are somewhat alike. Now, Lloyd Alexander didn't steal from Tolkien or vice versa. They just used some of the same sources. And quickly, I'll tell you this story because it's just kind of a favorite. Taran is a boy. He's a young boy, and he's about 15. You guess about maybe 14, 15, and he wants very much to be grown up. And he works with Kol, C-O-L, who is puts shoes on the horses. What is that called? Think for me.
Blacksmith.
Thank you, blacksmith. He's a blacksmith, and Taran thinks blacksmiths are really nothing exciting about being a blacksmith. And he doesn't have a title. All he can think of is being a prince and how princes look. And all he can think of is how they look. And he wants to be important. He wants to have a title. So Kol says, well, I will give you a title. One of his chores is taking care of the pigs. And he says, I will make you assistant pig keeper. Well, that was quite a title because one of the pigs' name is Henwen. And Henwen is a very important pig because I always think of Leo Bustead. Leo Bustead was here earlier, and he was telling of the glories of the pig and how we've made the pig something awful. I think he would love Henwen. Henwen is an oracular pig. She tells the future. Only you have to have special sticks, and only certain people, Dalban being one of them, can tell what she's saying. She can tell the future. So she's a very important pig. And Arwen wants to get his hands on Henwen. He's the evil guy. And Arwen has a black cauldron. And in this horrible black cauldron, he digs up corpses of people, and he puts them in the black cauldron, and they come alive again, and they become his servants of evil. And they have a certain radius from his area. Well, let's say that's his castle. And his power only goes out so far. And then these black riders, and Tolkien calls them black riders. Well, in here they're called the black cauldron riders or something like that because they come from this cauldron. See, they use some of the same sources. Only these riders, their power only goes out so far, and so then they have to turn around and go back. They can't get beyond their power, then, and they can't be killed. And their eyes have, when you see them, their eyes have no expression, and they're just in his power. And there's your evil. It's very distinct. There's good and there's evil. There's nothing in between, and children understand that. And you may say, well, that sounds horrible, corpses going into black cauldrons. Children, they understand that. I mean, they understand the distinction. That's between good and evil, and that's, they accept that because it's set up very clearly what is good and what isn't. Well, Taran is put in charge of Henwen. So what happens? You can pretty much guess. Henwen gets scared one day and runs away. And Taran goes running after her, and he's never been away from his little village. And he goes running after her, and of course he gets lost. And he finally falls asleep. He gets completely lost. And in the forest he meets a man, tall, and he has on this dirty cloak and these dirty pants. And he finds out eventually, he thinks he's just some old vagabond that's come by, and he kind of makes snide remarks and so forth. And he finds out eventually, the fella tells him that his name is Gwydion. And Taran jumps up. He says, "You can't be Gwydion. You can't be Prince Gwydion." And he says, "Why?" And he says, "Well, you don't look like Prince Gwydion." And so it's the way he does it is beautifully done, that that Taran has his picture of what a prince should look like. And then in the midst of this, Gwydion eventually tells Taran that Kaul, that here this old balding, fat little man that he worked with was a mighty warrior. And he says, "Kaul, oh, he couldn't have been a mighty warrior. Why he's fat and bald and short." And of course, he had been a mighty warrior. And so it's a beautiful illustration of being mighty doesn't always have to be size. And so Lloyd Alexander does a beautiful job with that. And then we meet a delightful character in here. They get captured by the evil. There's an evil queen in here, too, who helps Aunt Arwen. And they are captured. And Taran is put in a dungeon. And a little character by the name, and this is delightful. You get the impression she's just about Taran's age. And her name is Eilonwy. It's a Welsh, obviously a Welsh name. And she's just delightful. She pops around and she has a little magic ball that lights up. And the conversation between Taran and this little Eilonwy is really delightful in the story, because she's always saying, "Oh, you think you're a mighty warrior, well," and so you get the distinct, this is a good book for like the early teens, because there's this little bone of contention between these two. And she, of course, eventually helps him, but she goofs. And then he says, "Well, I thought you were going to get me out of here," you know, and they have all kinds of trouble. And they eventually do get out, and he tells Eilonwy about Gwydion, that Gwydion is there. And so, of course, she gets mixed up and gets the wrong person. And standing out waiting, he could see this great big figure, and he thinks, "Oh, at last, Prince Gwydion again on our horse, and we're off again. We can look for Henwy, and I can be on my way home." And he walks up, and here is this jovial character. And he goes, "Oh, no." And his name is Fluter Flam. And I'm pronouncing it that way, and I hope it's right. I left, one day I was absent, and I left the substitute with this book to read aloud. She wrote me a little note, and she says, "I don't know how you pronounce those words." And I said, "I just took a big, big guess." And I can't find it, but I call it Fluter Flam. It's Flam, but his first name is spelled just one. It's a wonderful name. I'm sure it's Welsh also. But he's a minstrel, and he's marvelous. He's jovial, and the ancient minstrels, you know, this gives the kids a lot of information too, because the old minstrels didn't just go around telling stories and playing instruments. They had to have a lot of expertise. They had to be excellent storytellers. They had to know volumes and volumes of stories. And they had to play instruments very well. They had to, and the kings and princes had their own private minstrels. And so if you were a professional minstrel, you were quite high up in the society, so to speak. Well, Fluter Flam is kind of a flop at a minstrel, let me put it that way. He doesn't quite measure up, and he has a lute that always tells the truth. And so he plunks on this to play his melodies, and he's always exaggerating. And every time he exaggerates, a string breaks. And so he'll get off, and he's exaggerating. He's telling about his exploits. Plung, a string will break. And eventually, Taran discovers this. You see, so then Fluter Flam has to be very careful, and he'll try not to exaggerate, and he'll try really hard, and pretty soon he gets carried away. Plunk, plunk, two strings will break. And the kids laugh, because he'll get so carried away, and these strings will break, and then Taran will look over, and you can just see him in your imagination. This is my fifth graders love this book. And Tarn will look over and so disgusted, like, well, you're doing it again. You're not telling the truth. Wouldn't it be marvelous if we all had an instrument like that?
We really have an orchestra.
Yeah. Yeah, something. This is called the Book of Three. And in it you meet a character by the name of Gurgi, G-U-R-G-I. And Gurgi is very much like Tolkien's Gollum. Only in here, Gurgi is doesn't quite have as much of the evil connotation that you get from Tolkien's Gollum, if you're familiar with Tolkien's. Gurgi in here is more of a pathetic, likable, very likable character. And he's always bowing and scraping. He reminds me of the Dickens, of a Dickens character. One of Dickens' characters, the one that was so humble. I don't know if you're familiar with I can't think of his name, Uriah Heep, that was constantly scraping and bowing, you know, just making you sick at your stomach. And of course, Uriah Heep was more evil. Well, Gurgi isn't he, but he's constantly scraping and bowing, and he comes up and he's always asking.